This is Afternoon Programming with L.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to, I had to look at one more time. I always do this shit at the beginning of every podcast. Episode 10 of Afternoon Programming. It's your boy L here. Today, I have another great guest on this week's episode. Man, I've been knowing you for years. I don't know how many years we've been knowing each other now. It's been like a hot minute.
About 2016, I want to say.
Really? Wow. Yeah. That's great. That's like, I think after, because I moved here in, was it 2016? Or yeah, I think it might have been 2016 or 2015. That's like when I got here, like in that beginning. Mm-hmm. But man, like there's so much history and there's a lot of dope shit that you're doing. And I just want to go ahead and introduce you so that way we can get going. Because it's like, there's like a lot of stuff that I want to ask you about just because, I mean, we know each other.
Right.
But like, I don't know like the roots of everything, if you know what I mean. But on today's episode of Afternoon Programming, we got my homie DJ Kerosene.
Salute. What's good, El?
Hey, what's going on, man?
Appreciate
chilling.
Appreciate you having me, man.
Of course. Before we go any further, just to make sure we get it out there, you want to promote like your social media or anything you want to push people towards?
Yeah, just at DJ Kerosene. Currently, you can hear me at Hip and Hops in East Atlanta on Fridays, the James Room right over here on the Beltline. On Saturdays, I got my party, The Nod, Atlanta's only strictly boom bap hip hop party. And then you can kind of catch me in the concerts and shows whenever, you know, the true school, raw, grimy, boom bap artists do things in Atlanta. I'm usually going to be involved.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, got a few other tricks up the sleeve, too, for the future endeavors.
Definitely. So I wanted to like let people, if for those of you who don't know, man, so you've been DJing for like how long, would you say?
I got my turntables, the same ones I use now, in 1998.
What? So, for real? The same ones?
Yep. Damn. In high school.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Was it like, did you buy it with your money? Was it like your parents?
It was a gift from my parents. And I mean, obsessed with hip hop.
Yeah.
As long as I can remember. Like, that's a whole nother story. But, you know, went to high school overseas in London. Yeah. And at that time, I was really more focused on the rapping and the producing, to be honest. But with being overseas, a lot of the records that we listened to, like one only came out on vinyl and it was all imports and stuff. So a lot of my British friends and myself, like everyone had turntables just to be able to listen to the records.
Of course.
So that was the primary reason we wanted them, just to be able to listen to stuff at the crib. But you know, as the record collection accumulated, that's when, you know, when the house parties and other stuff starts happening, it's like, all right, well, Kerosene, you're the only one with records. So the DJing, to be honest, it just kind of fell in my lap.
Okay, so it kind of just came with it and it just sort of naturally happened. And next thing you know, you were like, hey, you got turntables, let's do some parties or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Do you remember when you first got your tables, what was the first record you got?
Oh, nah. I mean, like, I definitely had some out of my parents and my grandparents' collection, but I can't remember like the first that I purchased. It was most likely, you know, some underground London hip hop from the late 90s though.
Gotcha. Do you remember like the I guess one, what's the first record that you remember? Was it like a Nas record or was it like a Jay-Z? Do you remember, was it like Mobb Deep or something like that that you can like?
Nah, I mean the first records is probably British hip hop.
British
hip hop. In all honesty, I mean, there's different records I had. Like, there's Nas records. I mean, even when I was doing, like, lounges and bars DJing in high school, it's like the mentality of people going out, I think people were just very much more open compared to nowadays.
Yeah.
As far as hearing music they're unfamiliar with.
Yeah.
And people went out to discover new music.
Exactly.
So I remember when Nas's Like dropped and it's just like, you know, you would have to take time out of your day, take the train to Soho, wait till the doors open and, you know, hope you snatch it up before a bunch of other DJs. And I remember like that night, I probably played Nas's like 5 times in a row at the party because you could just see
people
like, yo, what the fuck is this? Like,
exactly.
It's clearly Nas in Premiere, but it's like their first time
hearing that. Wow.
So I definitely remember experiences like that with specific records. You know, that doesn't really happen anymore.
No, of course. Now in today's like age of technology, you know, it's on YouTube or people just post it in tweets or whatever. Music just is, there's like a, I don't want to say like a oversaturation, but compared to like back in the day, you know, you kind of didn't know if a record dropped unless you were out there like actually trying to look for stuff to listen to, you know? But that's crazy. So then when you were DJing these events and stuff, like compared to, or no, no, I'm sorry, I know what I want to ask. So how long did you live in London before you came to the States?
I left, you know, I was born in New York. Then I did elementary school and junior high school in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
I was in a little suburb, Powell, like kind of like Sandy Springs in relation to Atlanta, like a little suburb of Columbus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then my father worked overseas in London. So I left Ohio after my freshman year, you know, did sophomore, junior, senior. And then I would go back. I would spend my summers and winter breaks out there for the first couple of years after I came back. And I came back to Boston. So I went to an American high school out there. So I was still in the American school system.
Gotcha.
And I didn't want to leave London. I didn't want to come back.
Like, yeah, yeah.
It was way harder. It was more of a culture shock coming back to America than it was leaving America.
Yeah.
So came back to Boston, went to Emerson in Boston, stayed in Boston for a couple years.
Mm-hmm.
After that, and then moved to Atlanta in 2007.
Since like going from like the high school to London, what are some of the differences you noticed as far as like hip hop when it, like, was there a lot of stuff that you discovered over there that they weren't playing, of course, over here, besides like, you know, London based artists, or was it vibing with different songs compared to out here?
I mean, the taste, as far as the American stuff, I would say that the taste was pretty similar to, you know, a lot of up north, East Coast, but that was still, you know, kind of the dominant region at the time as well. But the biggest differences was obviously the exposure to the British hip hop itself, which, like, to this day, that's still some of my favorite music ever. It's very hard to connect with people out here who are familiar with it or can relate to it. Like, they might see me get so excited about a song where they're like, what the fuck is this? I'm like, you don't understand how this used to ring off back then. Then just like a whole new set of slang. And then just culturally, man, like racially, it was very different as well. And as a white dude in hip hop, and I do consider myself a guest in the culture. So as a DJ or just a participant, I think I have, you know, I got a responsibility to represent properly and shine a light on the right shit. But
exactly. Just
I would say racially and class wise, like, things were a lot more mixed up out there. So it was kind of weirder coming back to America.
Seeing how things are dealing with people's
perception of that is like how they look at white people and hip hop in other countries as opposed to America.
Wow.
Now, still, like, you know, massive amounts of racism over there, and that's of course, universal globally. But this, as far as class system, like, it was a little different. It was a little more diverse.
I get that. So you're DJing. You said, like, do you remember like your first gig?
My first gig was like a, you know, just like a school event, like, not the cafeteria, but like a rec
like
center,
a gym, like,
yeah,
rec
like
center,
a gymnasium. Yeah. We just set the turntables and some speakers up in there and, you know, the little school dance. You know what I mean?
So, cause I remember you were telling me, so when you first started getting into DJ, it was more so you weren't even really like, I'm a DJ. You were like focused on the producing and the rapping.
Yep.
Was there a point where you were just like, maybe this is like the way to go? Did you remember having a moment, or maybe you did like a gig or connected with somebody that kind of, cause I feel like I've only known you since, like, I think we said 2016. And so I've known you as a DJ, like, basically as long as I met you. But for you, was there a moment you're like, okay, maybe DJ is going to lead me a little bit further down like this
way? It wasn't until I got to Atlanta, man. And I was DJing the entire time before that, you know, in London, in Boston. But, you know, another different thing back then, especially in the late 90s and the eras before me, I'm sure too, was just, you know, as a young person in hip hop, it's almost like you tried everything. Like, a lot of my friends were like that too. Like, I tried breakdancing. We was doing graffiti. I was rapping. And it was just like, no one expected to make a dollar out of any of it too. I think that's changed now too, where people approach these endeavors in hip hop or the elements or however you want to refer to them as more of a come up, or how can I turn this into a hustle? Or back then it was just like, this is really who we are. This is what we into. We connect with like-minded people and we kind of give it all a shot. And I was like really, really, really into the rapping in high school. I was still into it in college. But as I got older, I kind of accepted that that wasn't going to be the best fit in college. Switched my major a whole bunch of times until I landed on radio And even when in high school overseas, I had experience in pirate radio in the UK. So that was like underground illegal radio doing it. You know, we call them council estates over there. That's the equivalent of, you know, the projects in America. So we would do little pirate radio stations. Shout out. My man Excalibur came up with him doing that. And then that kind of transitioned into me eventually landing on college radio in Boston, which went extremely well for me. As a personality slash DJ, I really took a lot of pride in breaking the local Boston artists, which I felt, you know, I didn't see too many other people giving some of those artists a shot. And I just thought there was so much dope underground hip hop coming out at the time where, you know, I thought my role would best be like, all right, I trust my ear. I trust my taste. Let me, you know, expose the city to these artists. And then, you know, I got into commercial radio after graduating, which I absolutely hated. I didn't last long at all with that. Like, I've been floating around a lot of times. Like, the story's crazy. But, yeah, commercial radio wasn't for me. It just took... It took all the freedom and creativity out of it, in my opinion. And I kind of look at radio as the advertising business and not the music business. And that's of not course. What I got into it for. So stayed in Boston for a couple extra years. You know, got a crew out there, Bloody Bean Coalition. That was, you know, we was on some Wu-Tang shit, like 13, 14, 15 rappers. Wow. I was producing the majority of the records. And then that's when I started getting more, I guess you could say, management experience to where... I'd built up enough relationships through college radio to where I'm lining up the shows, I'm connecting us with promoters, I'm booking the photo shoots, I'm getting, you know, our clothes printed up and stitched up. So with them, I was producing, managing, and rapping. Occasionally doing some parties here and there in Boston, but I also felt like I had to leave Boston at some point if I stayed there. Like, you know, it was getting way too expensive and just... You know, I guess you could say running around in the streets wasn't, you know,
wasn't the best thing.
Worthwhile. Yeah. So I made a few trips out to L.A., had some peoples out there, wasn't really feeling the vibe or that it was a good fit for me at the time.
Okay.
And then I made a trip down to Atlanta. I was supposed to stay for 2 days at the time. I stayed for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Then I drove back up to Boston and a month later I just moved down here.
That's crazy.
And I had no plan. I didn't know anyone. My man Prof Bundy, who ended up being roommates later, and we ran with a lot of the same people in Boston, but had never met in person. We both moved down here a month apart from each other from Boston in August 2007. So we connected like really quickly, but I mean, I was applying to the Adidas store. Like, I had no plan. My turntables were still in storage at my parents' house, but I went out the first 7 nights in a row when I got down here. I mean, I was 24. Wow. I was wilding out.
You were just living
and
it up.
I went to like all the clubs and, you know, had a great time. But I was just approaching that as just like, let me get acclimated with the city and let me enjoy myself. And then like the last one I went to was the Django's and JC was spinning downstairs. And I walked downstairs and he's playing like Little Brother records. And that's when the light bulb went off. Like, oh, there's, you know... There's a lane for real hip hop down here too. And then I immediately got my turntables out of storage from my parents. I put ads up on MySpace that I was looking for DJ gigs. I mean, the story can keep going, but that's kind of, you know, looking at DJing like it was going to be something. It wasn't until I got down to Atlanta.
Wow. That it kind of transformed into that thing. You're like, okay, I'm going to do this now. Because you saw that lane and you were like, there's space for this here.
Right.
Wow.
Now I had to... You know, I had to get educated on where I was at, too, because I didn't grow up on a lot of the Southern hip hop that I had to learn once I got down here, and I had to respect where I'm at. Can't really change where I'm at, but I can offer, you know, my skill set as well. But I didn't look at like, oh, I'm going to be a DJ.
Yeah, exactly.
When I was young, even in my early 20s, like I moved down here at 24 and then the light bulbs just kind of went off. And then. The journey after that has really it snowballed from there. Like, there's been different waves, ups and downs with it. So,
okay, dope. Mm-hmm. So then to bring it back a little bit, because you said when you first came down here to visit, you said you were supposed to stay for 2 days.
Right.
2 days. So how did like, what happened that you were like, almost, that, how did 2 days transform into 2 weeks?
Oh, man. But like I said, my mind was set on leaving Boston.
Yeah.
I knew I had to. I came down here to visit a woman.
okay.
You know,
okay.
Shout out to her. And yeah, I think like I was just enjoying myself, but then just getting to explore the city and like really having no expectations of what Atlanta was going to be like. And then just there were so many different things that, you know, shock is the wrong word. Just like it was so different from Boston. Like everything was so spread out, but then I could be downtown and it feels like this is the real.
Of course,
metropolis part of the city, but then I can be over here and it's just all trees and greenery, and then the cost of living was so low, and then the nightlife was, the vibe was so different in the nightlife, and the food was different. And I was like, this is pretty cool, man. Like,
okay.
And just, I think being young enough and not, you know, being single, having no kids, not really having that many commitments to stay in Boston. You know, it was the right time to kind of just take the leap of faith.
I got you. That makes a lot of sense. Cause I know for me, it kind of happened in the same way, not in the same way I say, cause like originally before I even moved here in 2016, 15, whatever year it was, I think it was 2016. I was initially planning to move to LA.
Right.
And that was the move. And because at the time, before I got into photography, before I got into any of that, I went to school for like film, you know, I'm over here doing videos, shooting music videos back home in Arkansas. And then I was like, working at this job and they were like, you get, I took like a week off from work to just to go out to LA. Cause I had like some friends out there who were all together living in this one apartment, trying to make it out there. But then the more I got out there, I was like, I like the vibe out there, but it's just too expensive and I can't afford it.
Yeah, yeah. And like, you know? Even when I said that I wasn't feeling LA, that like, I love LA. Yeah. And I love going out there now and I loved it back then. I had friends out there. I love the vibe, but I didn't really see a lane open for me musically. Mm. I didn't know how I would be able to afford it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I just didn't think it was the right fit. Mm. Whereas Atlanta, when I came down here, I was like, I think I could make something pop down here.
No, definitely. Because that's what it feels like when I got here, or like the stars aligned, as some people say. It's like I came out here and I'm like, yo, this feels dope. Mm-hmm. Kind of like you were describing, like the vibe is dope. The people are dope. The city, the way it's built and everything just is dope to me, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I love this. And I was just like, maybe this, I'm going to make this like my second, plant my flag over here for a little bit, you know.
And I love the... to this day, I mean, back, I spotted it real quickly back then and it's still the same today. I just love the sense of community amongst the, you know, the creatives, as we say,
like, exactly.
And just even with DJing being one component of that creative community, just with there being room for everyone, there's more than enough venues. There's, you know, there's a lot of ownership down here.
Exactly.
So yeah, I thought that was real dope.
No, definitely. So it brings me, so you moved down here to Atlanta and you're DJing. Like, do you, when you first moved down here, you're like, okay, bet, I'm just about to try to do as many events as I can, connect myself. Or like, how did that go about? Like, you were just looking like for gigs, or, you know, how hard was that to sort of get started down here and be like, let me build a base here? You know?
And that's why I was saying, like, it kind of snowballed. So I had the ads up on MySpace. First people to reach back to me on MySpace was a swinger group, and I DJed at this bar that's still there to this day, Ideal Sports Bar on Lakewood Avenue. It's a couple blocks away from the Dungeon.
Okay.
You know, Dungeon Family, Outkast, Goody Mob. Shout out to them. And I got booed the first time I DJed.
Wow, like, really?
You know, not like tomatoes thrown at me or whatever, but like I came in there playing a whole bunch of Mob Deep and D-Block and Wu-Tang, and
they weren't trying to hear it.
Goddamn, Charlie, where that Kilo Ali at? And I was like, I didn't even know what Kilo Ali was. Like, so I had to get educated. I had to recognize where I was at. And then I remember I went back to my apartment that week. I probably didn't see sunlight for like a week. I just studied the music and downloaded as much as I could and came back. And I looked at that venue. It's kind of like my training grounds to get comfortable musically in Atlanta.
Of course, yeah.
And then, you know, I really, you know, came up, I would say, out here on Peter Street. in Castleberry Hill. And like my man Bundy, he was doing security over at M Bar. And I would just like, I would record mixes at the crib, burn them on CDs, and just kind of run around the city and just leave them with the bartender, try to find out who the owner or manager was and leave them there. And Bundy kind of plugged me into M Bar. Slice, legendary Slice, was next door.
Wow.
The bartenders over there were real cool. And I just kind of got in there, you know, that they listened to it. They gave me a shot. M Bar, there was a big group of promoters over there. They were part owners and promoters called ATL Bars.
Okay.
Shout out Mel, Malik, and, you know, good peoples to this day. They gave me a shot in the bigger venues right away. They put me in the Mark downtown. And that at the time, they had, like, Kemet, Salah, Sha Kim, and they put me right in there with them. They put me at this other joint. It was, like, a three-level spot on Peachtree by where Gladys Knights used to be, Verve. They put me in the main room at Verve. Wow. So it was like people just really taking a chance on me. I remember the promoters at the time just thinking like my musical selection in my sets was just a little different. They weren't used to hearing, you know, someone throw on a Beat Nuts record like at the peak of the night. And then once I got in Slice, like that was a really good fit for me. And the community, even in that bar and that lounge, like a bunch of us are still personal friends to this day, even if people have moved out of the creative community. So I just think the camaraderie over there was real beneficial to me. It was just on some Cheers shit where it's just you show up and everyone's going to know each other. You're going to know the DJs. The DJs get to know the crowd real well. And then things snowballed from there too. Like I remember, you know, I would throw on a random record. I'd throw on a Prodigy record and I'll meet someone. I remember I met this kid, the C Students. He was a promoter and he's like, yo, I'm booking this dude K-Dot. I got this guy, Kendrick Lamar, coming out here at Masquerade. Like, and like this guy, Dom Kennedy, is opening for him and Schoolboy Q and Sci-Hi. Like when they were the opening acts and man.
Wow. Like, so you saw a lot of early artists who now are like crazy big and up there.
But just my way of landing those was like completely different from nowadays. Like when younger DJs are like, how should I go about trying to find gigs or get my name out there? I'm like, I kind of went about it in a way that you can't do anymore.
It nowadays. Yeah.
You know what I mean? There wasn't even Twitter out yet. My space was on the way out, but I mean, definitely no Instagram. Social media wasn't popping.
It's crazy because back in the day, you basically had to take a more hands-on approach.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, versus nowadays, you can just like send a DM or a message now.
Right,
email.
Right. But I'm thankful for having that experience because it's like, you know, like when Instagram went down the other day, it's like, I'll be fine. Like, I know how to function without it. Like, I did that wave in London, Boston, and when I first got down here of not being able to utilize things like that. So now those things are just a bonus. Those only add to it. Now, with people from my generation, like we got to learn how to navigate
social media,
those digital arenas as effectively as, you know, like the folks younger than myself
that are like doing it. And it's crazy seeing how a lot of them are doing it nowadays, like with social media and stuff, which I wanted to ask you, how do you feel about, do you think, because I know a lot of DJs besides you and just like everybody is like super dope. With the way social media is now, you know, back in the day, DJs were like basically like your record breakers. They were the ones putting people on to stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Now that, you know, we got Spotify, Twitter, and people and artists can post their things. Do you think the importance of a DJ has gone down, or do you think it's become even more important to be like a quality DJ?
I think it's shifted. I think it's changed. I wouldn't say it gone down, but people consume music entirely different. Like when I'm telling that story about the Nas record and people going out to discover new music, unless it's a, you know, event specifically curated for that, or the owner of the event is known for that and people know to go to the event for it. You know, people don't really go out for the same reasons. I think now it's just like, and a bunch of my OGs and peers and friends in the DJ game always pushed me to be like, you know, you can't just chase these random gigs or residencies anymore. You kind of got to have ownership over something. And then have, I know everyone likes to say like on Instagram, like we're all our own brands, but you know, if you're in a profession and you can utilize social media to make money from it, then yeah, branding is very important. I think the DJs have shifted more into a brand space.
I could see that.
And I think it's going to be in a whole nother space in another 5 to 10 years when, you know, my theory is just the virtual realm is just going to, I think people are really underestimating how heavy the virtual entertainment is going to be in the next 5 to 10 years and what the role of a DJ will or won't be at that point.
No, definitely. That actually makes a lot of sense because I was thinking about, there's like parts of me, like, because I was born in 89, right? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of grew up in a little bit before the internet really took off. So I knew a little bit of what you're talking about before when Instagram went down. I was like, oh, okay, it's normal. It is what it is.
I took a nap.
And then you woke up and it was back on.
Right. I was fine.
But it's so interesting the way that, like, I'm always surprised at the, for example, like, virtual reality. Let's talk about that for a second. Like, how it started and now it's like there's crazy, like, as far as like quality, like, you know, if you ever played a video game, like these things just keep getting better and better and better eventually to where it almost looks like it's real, right. And so I'm like, damn, do people, because a part of me goes, why do people want to do this and live in this virtual space? And I'm thinking that maybe they're gonna have like these virtual parties and you know what I'm talking about, and then DJs can DJ from their house but still do this like virtual reality type of thing. Because
COVID and the Twitch, the streaming era only accelerated that.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Because people being scared to go out. So they're like, well, I'll stay safe here, but I still get to listen to a DJ that I think is dope. Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of that when you say that, like, it's kind of crazy because it makes me think of like, you know, Solection, like they're DJs and like they have like a somewhat of a sound, almost like they curate for a specific type of vibe and shit like that. And so I think what you were saying earlier, it makes sense because I think things are shifting. Do you think it's going to be more so like, how do you think it's going to shift is what I'm trying to ask.
I'm hoping that I got other hustles in place at that time because, like, I don't want to be the dude like fighting it and the old head where it's just like, it got to go back to the way it was when I was coming up because it's never going to go back.
Yeah.
But, I think the algorithms are going to get so advanced. I think, you know, with the technology developing exponentially, you know, when it gets to the point where, you know, maybe we'll see a new iPhone drop in every 3 months.
Wow.
Or, you know, there won't be DJs working in nightlife in the capacity that they are right now. I think it'll always exist to some extent.
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't really want to be a part of it, like, in that realm. I think the face-to-face and, you know, the people getting each other's pheromones and all that and just the experience. I just think, you know, call me old school, call me traditional.
Yeah.
You know, I think that always needs to be there. Now, during quarantine and during COVID, like, I'm very thankful that streaming was there because that's how I made my bread and butter for a year. Like, I made more money DJing on Instagram Live a lot of times than I would have at a regular gig.
That's crazy.
There were a lot of benefits. You know, creatively, I got to play 100% whatever I wanted.
Of course.
With no promoter, owner, or manager like trying to micromanage me or you know, so there were those things, but I definitely didn't like, and then being able to do it from home and get drunk in my bedroom and not have to drunk drive afterwards and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I definitely, it was weird, awkward, and uncomfortable as far as like, you know, just psychologically, we're only going to interact with each other through this screen,
or we're only
going to type to each other. I've seen someone point out where it's like the streaming era has made people think that it's acceptable to talk to DJs while they're working because you're in the comments. So I don't know, man. I mean, it's unpredictable, but I mean, change is guaranteed.
Mm.
And if it's, you know,
it's just no telling which way it could go.
No telling. And I would like to have my portfolio nice and diversified, you know, by that point. I think the clubs, there's going to be, you know, you walk in and it might be LED screens on the floor and the ceiling and the walls and be like, for one night only, it looks like we're in the Sahara Desert, or for one night only, it looks like we're here. And who knows how advanced the hardware for the DJs is going to be. And, you know, it's going to be, it's also going to be less and less of a serious commitment to jump in the game.
Mm.
And I see that with DJing, photography, graphic design. Like, at that point that I jumped in it, like,
Yeah.
You had to be real serious. Yeah. You definitely had to have more money, make a financial commitment and a time commitment.
Yeah.
If I got to take the train for hours there and back and spend this money on the physical records, like that's not as simple as just, you know, what exactly. you can do nowadays. So
definitely.
Yeah. I just expect people got to buckle up, man. People got to buckle up.
No, definitely. All the information that you're dropping is crazy, because it makes, these are some of the things I think about too, because what you were talking about, like a possibility of like, all right, this one night we're going to be in the Sahara Desert. I don't know if you've seen these things. They've been happening not just in Atlanta, but in like the bigger cities where they're like, you know, come look at the these Van Gogh paintings that are like just super things. And I'm like, who is that? You know, I'm like, okay, they're trying things to see what's going on. I'm like, I wonder if that could be like a thing where, all right, y'all, this is the theme for the night. You know what I'm talking about? Like you're saying, the Sahara Desert, and it's a DJ, dance floor, bar, whatever.
Right.
And so I can only imagine how crazy advanced the technology is going to get. Cause I mean, you see like from iPhone to iPhone, they just keep upgrading it. And then every other phone as well, just like how quickly things are like ramping and speeding up, especially if you noticed it during like quarantine when you were stuck at home, like you said, streaming and everything just launched and stuff.
Right.
And so it's just super wild, because like you said, there's a part of me that kind of like, we should always have parties in a space where we can all see each other and you can feel that energy.
Right.
Because like I've been in those places like with you, if you're DJing or Raw, we know like where you play that one song and then it just like gets everybody turned up, or they just like, oh shit, they didn't expect to hear that song, you know, feeling that energy. It's the same thing like a performance to me, you know,
and just the fellowship element to it. And just, you know, I just never want to have to strictly 100% rely on the technology. And that's kind of where, like, for lack of a better word, the branding comes into play. Like, for example, how in this market, I just take pride in, you know, a lot of times I'll say, if you book Kerosene, you get Kerosene. And I feel like there's 1,000 jukebox DJs. There's 1,000 DJs that are playing the same 100 songs every night.
Yeah.
To where I want to be one of the, there's many other DJs like this too, but I want to be one of the DJs where, you know, you go out and you don't even have to see that it's me. But once you hear the music, be like, ah, yeah, that's Kerosene. Like, if a Griselda artist, if an underground artist drops a new album tomorrow, I'm like, there needs to be somewhere in Atlanta that you can go to hear it. And I want to be the person to provide that. And I feel that just establishing that brand or that trust with my followers or supporters, that when and if it does transition to something crazy and virtual, and hopefully I'll still be able to do something in person, face to face, and utilize the digital realm too. But they're not going to be coming to me for, you know, the all, it's so cool that I can put this helmet and bodysuit on and experience this. No, it's still going to be, oh, I'm still going to this person for what they provide that I can't get from someone else.
Exactly.
Unless the algorithms get so advanced that it can provide it itself.
No, definitely. I definitely get that. I wanted to touch on real quick about, you've had some like crazy gigs. When I say crazy, it's like the people that you've worked with, like the artists. Cause like, I remember when you broke the news, you went on tour with like Nas and Lauryn Hill.
Well, I DJ for an artist, Nick Grant.
Nick Grant, yeah. And, shout out to Nick.
Yeah, that year, he got a lot of amazing music on the way too. I said he's the best.
I was wondering,
the best rapper in the game. I stand on that wholeheartedly. And if you don't know that yet, you're about to find out. But yeah, 2017, we did one tour with Ab Soul from TDE.
Okay.
And then a few months later, we went on the Powernomics tour with Nas and Lauryn Hill.
Wow. So how did that connection happen? Was it between like just people you knew and they recommended you, or is it kind of like?
Yeah, I mean, that's with Nick and you know, the label he was at the time and a lot of his relationships, and, you know, he already had a relationship with Nas.
Okay.
You know, the labels behind him were definitely putting their work in on the back end, you know, solidifying that connection. And, it just kind of all fell in place. But even when we were on the Ab Soul tour, we did a date in New Orleans. We did the House of Blues. And we actually ended up having, there's a private restaurant on the top floor of the House of Blues.
Okay.
And, you know, the big homie Shaka Zulu lined it up, and we did a private dinner with Nas that night.
Wow.
So like there was, six or seven of us. Scotty ATL was there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we had dinner with Nas for like 4 or 5 hours, which was
crazy.
It was a trip, man. That was definitely one of the most memorable experiences I've had. And then, you know, right after that, to be on tour with those artists, with my favorite artists.
Of course,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it was incredible.
So what's it like when you hear the news like, hey, you're going on tour with Nas and Lauryn Hill? What's that feeling like? Were you like, okay, bet? You just kind of were like, whatever, we doing this now. Did you like celebrate at all? You were like, oh shit, I never thought.
There was like, it was a combination. There was the shock, like, oh wow, like this is really happening. But then there was the, you know, the ego kicks in and the confidence, like, yeah, like this is where I'm supposed to be at.
Yeah.
And then just, you know, looking at, you know, all those years of preparation and passion for the music and sacrificing. It's like, it's paying off right now. You know what I mean?
No, definitely. Word. Definitely. So like, did you get to talk to Nas at all? And you'd be like, hey, I fuck with Illmatic's classic record, you know, or was it like,
I mean, that dinner? We talked about a lot of music stuff and it was just bugged out to have, you know, your favorite rapper sitting in front of you. And then it's like, this just sounds like I'm having a conversation with one of my homies. So like that experience took like any starstruck element I had about rappers and celebrities. Yeah. It kind of, you know, lifted that, removed that in a positive way. It was, I mean, he's just as laid back as you would expect. Real cool dude, man.
That's crazy. But that's so dope. And then we can touch on, besides working like with great Nas and Lauryn Hill, how did you link with West Side Gunn?
Word. Well, shout out, you know, the big homie Static Selector, you know, came up with Static around the same time. You know, he had already been putting in the groundwork in the New England and Boston and New Hampshire area years before I had arrived out there. But, you know, Static was killing it in Boston. He had, you know, Show Off Records popping.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing like the street team promotions for like Interscope and G-Unit and all that. So I was actually interning for Static after I left the radio stuff and after I got out of college. So our relationship was always cool. And then, you know, he had moved to New York when I moved to Atlanta. And whenever Static would come down here, like, you know, he was DJing for Joey Badass.
Yeah.
Like, I would always DJ. I would be the in-house DJ for the Joey Badass show. So there was one night, like, we were, after the show, we were in the parking lot and Static just introducing me to people. He's like, yeah, this the homie Westside Gunn. And this is like pre-Griselda. This is like still kind of street entertainment. And Wes had his CDs. He had the Hitler 1 CD he was giving to people. And we all went to Tree Sound that night. Joey was recording. Book Brown was there. Johnny Shipes was there. And, you know, so it's like, it was dope to meet Wes from that point, like pre-Griselda. Watch the come up since then. And then, you know, we just kind of always kept in touch. And then, you know, I'd be DJing another show. I'd be DJing the Royce the 5'9 show. And Wes and Conway would pull up after they dropped the Griselda Ghost shit. And it's just like, to fuck with them, you know, really off of the strength of the music and the relationship, as opposed to like, this is the wave, this is the trend right now. Like, I took a lot of pride in that, man, where it's like, it wasn't no politics or using you to get on, or I want to align myself with you
because
you're popping. It's like, nah, the music is dope, and I can foresee, like, once people become
catch
aware of this, like, this is
gonna
be something serious. And I mean, look where things have ended up,
man. You know that, it's crazy because, like, I met him when he was finishing Supreme Blind Tell, or it was done. I was shooting the cover, and I was, because you hit me, and I was like, okay, at first I was like, I don't know who West is, but, you know, I was like, well, I trust, because, I mean, you only fuck with dope shit or dope artists, you know?
And that was a crazy night. I was sitting outside the gig, I was in the car, and, like, I just happened to be, I think I was on Twitter or something at the time, and I seen West just tweet, like, you know, I need a photographer, quick, like, if anyone knows anyone. But, you know, the timestamp, like, it was within the past minute. I must have seen it, like, I just happened to see it right when he posted it. So I just call him. I'm like, yo, man, I got this dude, Elmatic, man. Like, he dope. He do all my work. I just lined him up with Big Crit and, like, got get
That's
this dude
crazy.
A shot. And then from what you told me, like, the numbers got exchanged and he immediately reached out, pulled up right away and made magic happen, man.
Yeah, it was super wild because I remember that night and everything. And, like, just, like, I'll never forget that. And so it's crazy because I wanted to ask you, so when you first met him, like, and you listen to the music, you were like, oh yeah, this it's going to take some time. It's bubbling. It's mm-hmm. going to take some time, and it's just going to blow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Definitely, man.
That's crazy. And like now, and then you see, like you said, where Wes is now. It's like, I'm always amazed, like when you kind of, it's special when you see people like where they start, or not kind of where they start, but like early on before they're actually like just right. take off. And like, I've witnessed that, like, luckily, like a handful of times with people, you know, just mm-hmm. like, cause I was like, damn, we like Supreme Blind Tell was crazy. Like, yo, this is dope. And I love boom bap. I grew up listening to a lot of boom bap artists coming from Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And then to see the trajectory of where he's going still, you know,
right? Yeah.
It's just like, damn,
still only the beginning.
Exactly. Right. And it's like, next thing you know, I remember after that meeting Benny, shout out to Benny the Butcher, and then Conway, I'm like, yo, all these, they're all dope as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And so to know that there's still room for like boom bap, because sometimes, you know, in the mainstream, it's not really like pushed out there as much.
Right.
And so you gotta sometimes have to go look for that, but it's just wild. I wanted to leave with like one more question I wanted to ask you. What is like, well, first, real quick, I want to ask, do you have a favorite gig that you've ever done?
Favorite gig that I've ever done?
Whether it be for like a party, or it be for like when you DJed for an artist or something like that, that you just like, damn, like this is like one of the best nights I've had.
Oh, man. There's a lot, man. I mean, obviously my own parties, man, the nod, just being able to do what I want. I definitely miss doing the pretty sweet parties. I definitely miss Slice on Peter Street. That era mm-hmm. was ridiculous. There's just so many to try to comb through, man. There's not mm-hmm. like a particular one or like mm-hmm. a top five. There's been a lot of concerts. You know, Fort Knox and I have done hundreds of joints out here.
Mm-hmm.
The whole Nas tour. Definitely
crazy.
Doing Rakim and Big Daddy Kane
Oof.
At A3C one year was crazy. You know, done various joints with the Wu-Tang Cats, done a couple joints with Raekwon. The Lock Show was crazy. I remember you was with me that night doing the photography. They brought out
50 Cent,
2 Chainz, Khaled.
I remember that was crazy. I was like, what the hell?
I brought Wes and Benny to that show that night.
Damn.
And like got them backstage and in the room with Jadakiss. And it's like, just to watch the artist journey from that point. Man.
That's wild, because like I said, there's so many things going on. Sometimes you kind of forget, because I was like, oh, shit. They
one
were
of,
there.
One of DBIC and Sean's parties when they did the Hola Ho Vito, they did a Jay-Z-themed party at Space 2 over on Edgewood. That was a very memorable night.
Wow.
Set went great. Crowd energy was incredible. There's just so many, man.
Yeah, so many. No, definitely.
I need to reflect on that, so I got a better answer, man.
No, it's all good, because like you're helping me remember. I'm like, oh shit, I forgot, because I'd be forgetting shit. And mm-hmm. so like sometimes like, oh yeah, this shit did happen. I was there. I was here.
Oh, and when I did 26 hours straight on Instagram like, Live during quarantine.
I remember when you did that. I was like, yo, how is this man? Like, just you just kept going. A lot
of
energy drinks.
Nah, a lot of alcohol. Because it was just commonplace for me at that time. Like, I did this thing called like Stimulus Saturdays. And then I had a theme night called Cruise Control, where I would focus on like hip hop groups, duos, clicks and all that. And then I would hop on sporadically sometimes.
Mm.
And it was just the norm where, you know, if I started at 10 o'clock, like I'll do 9 hours, 10 hours, 11 hours, like it was nothing.
Yeah.
And there was one night, you know, I think I started at 10. And around 1 or 2 a.m., people in the comments like, yo, you going 9-10 hours tonight? And I'm like, hey, man, fuck it. Why don't I go 24 hours straight? And there's just something how my brain works, I guess. It's like once I put it out there and like in front of people and publicly, it's like, all right, now I got to hold myself to it.
Damn, and, I feel it. Yeah.
Yeah. Halfway through it, I was like, this is the worst idea. I'm not going to make it. I wasn't talking on the mic anymore. I pulled a chair up to the turntables.
He was like, oh, shit.
And then it started raining outside.
Uh-huh.
And I just like something clicked. And I did a whole hour straight of songs with only with rain in the title.
Wow.
Then I did like a reggae set. Then I did a sample set. And it's just like the adrenaline kicked back in, got the second wind. And then, before you know it.
Holy,
you know, Guinness Book of World Records supposed to hit me up. Like,
yeah, I know.
New Face, make that happen, man.
Shout out to New Face. Then the last thing I want to leave people with is, do you have any, you know, it's obvious you've worked with so many people, so many greats, and like your trajectory as well. Is just like, it's crazy just from, you know, being in London to coming back to the States to being exposed to a lot of things. Do you have any advice for like anybody else that wants to like go down the same path as you, as far as like being a DJ, or just really any words of wisdom to live by that kind of helped you get to where you are now?
I wouldn't even say I'm in the position to advise anyone else what to do. I'm still figuring it out myself,
yeah.
Which is also a testament to, like, I would say you definitely got to be passionate about it. You definitely got to love it, because if you don't, like, you're not going to be able to weather, you know, the bumps in the road.
Yeah.
And yeah, just keep the music first, keep the love first, keep the creativity over the commerce. Mm. You know, God willing, you can make it to the position where you're lucky enough to make a living off of your craft,
yeah,
or make a living off of art. You know, don't get caught up in comparing yourself to, you know, what you see other people doing or what it looks like what they're doing, because the social media stuff can really make things look bigger than what it actually is. So when you're looking at your peers or even your competition, just try to keep them in an inspirational space. And just keep a balance, man. Stay disciplined, get ready to make sacrifices, and yeah, just keep the love first, man.
Definitely dope. Appreciate that, Kerosene. Before we go, real quick, you want to promo your social medias again, where they can find you, or just anything you want to push out there?
Or just at DJ Kerosene, at the Nod ATL. And just stay tuned, man. Appreciate you for having me, man.
No, definitely. It's all love, Kerosene. For those still listening or watching on YouTube, follow Afternoon Programming on Instagram at Afternoon Programming. This episode is like dope, man. I love doing this just because you get so many gems from everybody, and just it's good to catch up, especially with everything going on now.
Most definitely.
But other than that, everybody, thank y'all for listening or watching, and I'll catch y'all next week. Peace.
Peace.